When you have a major bill that changes life and no one in the other party supports it, it becomes an open sore for the next 20 years. And that's what we're living with.
This is Dan Diamond, and you're listening to Pulse Check. The fight over Obamacare may never end. That's one takeaway from this week's news, with Republicans seizing on rate hikes on healthcare.gov and trying to make it a last-ditch campaign issue. But it's also a clear lesson from the new Politico Harvard poll, which was conducted before the rate hike news hit. According to the poll, 94% of Donald Trump voters, 94%, say that Obamacare is working poorly. Contrast that with Hillary Clinton supporters. 79% of them believe that the law is working well. And yes, not to bury the lead, but we at Politico are doing a series of polls with Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health. You can find those polls by searching the Politico Harvard hashtag, all one word, on Twitter. They're also linked in the Thursday issue of Pulse, and they're on the Politico website right now. Harvard's Bob Lenden was in the office earlier this month. He gave us a preview of the latest poll results, and I pulled him in for a podcast. I also asked Joanne Kennan, executive editor of Healthcare, and my boss, to join us too. We talked about the healthcare issues that polled well, the ones that polled poorly, how healthcare has changed over time as a political issue, and what Bob, as really one of the giants in public polling, what he sees about this election and about the evolution of Obamacare. Now, another reminder, we recorded this conversation before the big Obamacare news hit this week. But to paraphrase a certain political candidate, I think the fundamentals of this podcast remain strong. You can use the time cues to skip around and find the topics that we discuss. And with that, it's Harvard's Bob Lenden and Politico's Joanne Kennan. So it's rare to interview your boss. And Joanne, this is a question that I've very much wanted an answer to. We, the Politico Health team, we're now doing a poll with Harvard. Does the world need another healthcare poll?
When Bob Lenden called me up and said, "Do you want a poll with me?" it took me about 2.5 seconds to realize the answer would be yes. I think there's a lot of polls, but Bob, who's been someone who's help me learn to think about the politics of healthcare, it knows more than anybody else. And so when they said, "You want to play?" I said, "Show me the swings."
I think it's important to reiterate to listeners, Bob is like the dean of health policy polling.
He's actually, it's part of his title, he is a dean. But yeah, he is not the dean. He's at Harvard Public School of Public Health. He's a dean.
We should conduct a poll whether Bob Lenden is thought of as the dean of polling or just a dean at Harvard.
Right.
I feel like the answer is the.
But I mean, I think Bob has been thinking about the politics of healthcare deeply. And also, this let us help design the polls into a series of polls on health and some other domestic policies. So it was a really good thing for political reporters and editors to sort of start thinking, too, about how to refine things we assumed. Can we test them? Are they right? And I think particularly last month when we had a trade component, there were a lot of surprises. You know, basically Democrats think about trade the way Republicans used to and vice versa.
You're talking about the first poll in this
right,
series, which
right.
focused on trade and economic policy in
and
healthcare, to
healthcare. Right. And this one we're talking about now was entirely healthcare coming out before the election. Over the next few months, we will be doing a combination of health and other domestic policy, which sort of fits our growth here at Politico, and it really gives a new component to our journalism, and then we're all learning a lot about how to ask smart questions.
Okay, so let's talk about this poll. We have this new poll. It's on Clinton voters versus Trump voters on healthcare issues. There are lots of ways to read the takeaways here. There's implications on Medicare, on Obamacare, abortion, Medicaid, and so on. So, Bob, from your perspective, what is the number one story of this poll?
The number one story is that, particularly on the Affordable Care Act, what is driving people's views is their overall values and beliefs about what government should be doing. And it's less how the exchanges are doing or whether or not the co-pays and deductibles. There's a very fixed point of view where a large share of Americans want the government to be involved very heavily in solving the problems that exist. The other half of America really are afraid of the government. They're concerned about what it will do to their health care and medicine. And what they want is the government not to play a major role. Turns out that that drives right away, if I want a major role for government, I like the ACA. If I don't want a major role, I don't like it. It's hard to believe they read through all 1,700 pages. It turns out to be this more philosophical, and that helps explain the House that voted 60 times to repeal it. Why did they do that? Why don't they just settle and move on in life? And that's because they have a constituency that really is concerned about government's expansion in medicine and healthcare. And that's unique about this, because most of the polling just asks you, do I favor or oppose? It doesn't ask a lot about your
deep-seated
views and values. So that is the biggest takeaway. And it's important not only for now, but for the future, because people who feel that way, if Republicans particularly have the House or the Senate, even if Secretary Clinton is president, they're not going to feel that they want the government to solve these things and expand this program and fix it, because they're worried about the scale of federal involvement for it. And if you do this on a day-to-day basis, oh, there's exchange. Did you read about what happened in Tennessee? Oh, the deductibles are
Tennessee,
up.
Tennessee, where the insurance companies are hiking rates or potentially
out.
Leaving
and
market.
All of this obviously makes people nervous, but it's clear what is driving people is their real concern or belief that government has to go in there and fix this versus the other.
I think that Democrats or supporters of the Affordable Care Act all along have underestimated the intensity and the durability of the opposition, because they didn't really understand the point that Bob just made, that health care is a proxy for how do you feel about government. And when I've heard some pro-ACA people say, well, you know, it's called Obamacare, and as soon as Obama leaves office, the tensions will go away, my response was, yeah, Hillary Clinton will really solve
yes.
that. But I think this gives us data to support that. The divide is really, really deep. It doesn't mean that however things turn out after November, that, you know, it's such a bizarre year, and we don't really know how people are going to read what happened this year in terms of how they proceed. But what we're seeing is partisanship. We're not seeing, on January 20th, we'll just sit down and fix everything.
One takeaway that I thought was interesting from the poll is that only 18% of respondents said we want to keep Obamacare the way it is. Now, the way that it could change varies quite a bit between the parties, with Democrats more in favor of what would be seen as constructive reforms on the law, building it out, adding a public option, for instance, and Republicans wanting more repeal. I'm curious, Joanne, as someone who's written about this space for years, do you feel like we're kind of stuck in the same cycle when it comes to this battle? Do you feel like there's any hope that we will get to a point where these battles won't be fought?
I mean, right now, if you look at this data, you don't see a lot of optimism for deals. On the other hand, you know, the next election campaign starts the day this one ends, and whether people are going to decide, you know, that there are some areas, I'm not seeing a great deal of indications that we're going to enter this sudden era of bipartisan cooperation. I don't see many signs of that. There could be some deals struck that we can't totally visualize right now. There could be some pragmatic people who say on the Republican side, you know, either we wait for it to collapse, but we don't have a great solution if that happens, or we try to pull it in our, you know, cut some deals, pull it in our direction, shrink it a little bit, make it a little bit more conservative-friendly in exchange for X, Y, and Z that the Republicans also want, and I don't have a clear handle on what that could be. But, you know, could we have a brief window of some kind of deal, I get this and you get that? This poll is not showing us it's likely. We don't really know how the chemistry of the new Congress will act and what they'll see in their own interests.
But in support of Joanne, what it does say is that the only way out of this is to have a trade where the other fact is something else beyond health care.
Right. Could it be a deal with taxes?
Yes. You say to Republicans, we're not going to win on this. How about something you care about? And we'll move on a tax bill, which is the most obvious, that we might necessarily not want. In return, that you allow four or five reforms to go, so the ACA goes on. But the importance of the poll is it says to you, don't think you're going to convince them to come in and fix this bill.
The only way you're going to negotiate is to offer the more classic Lyndon Johnson. Let's not argue over this. Here's a bridge, a tunnel, a new program, something else. For it, but this is not something that's going to be solved by two people across the table.
And when we're talking about a deal, we are, yeah. I mean, we're doing this interview at a time when Hillary Clinton is up in the polls, and we're talking about a deal
with
Republicans still have at least one chamber, that she is present. That's our presumption in terms of talking about a deal. Obviously, with Trump, it would be much more of a dismantling. He couldn't, technically, would there be an outright repeal? That's hard to do. Could you do a lot of damage really fast? Yes.
And in the unlikely scenario, though not impossible, where Clinton takes the White House and Democrats take both parts of Congress, then we're playing with a very different deck of cards.
Yes.
Even then it would be, the Democrats, I don't think any of us are anticipating at this point in October that they're going to get 60 votes. And remember, even when they did have 60 votes, There were centrist Democrats who did not go back in the early months of the Obama administration, the first year and a half, when there were 60 votes. You know, they didn't go for the public option. They didn't go for, government negotiation of Medicare drugs. They didn't go for a lot of things that the progressives wanted. The law was a big compromise, and that's when you see the Democrats who don't love it the way it is. It's because they want other things in it.
There's a reason it took 14 months to get Obamacare, and it wasn't just the Republicans. It was the moderate Democrats or the more conservative ones who held out for various things, too. The piece that is interesting to me here is maybe one space of negotiation jumps out is drug reform. And the poll said that 73% of all respondents in favor of Medicare negotiating drug prices, more on the Democratic side than Republican side, 83% of Clinton voters, 64% of Trump supporters. So are we seeing overall a new attitude about drug price reform, or is this just an issue that's been around for a long time and now we're asking questions about it because it's moved more to the forefront?
I think there's a window of opportunity. Pharmaceutical companies will wish that, this is like the storm coming up the coast. But what you have is people who say, I don't want the government to play a big role, saying, do something about drug prices. So you have a bipartisan moment when people are pushing away and saying, forget my philosophy here. I'm really worried about the drug price issue. And so the possibility that some bipartisan agreement could be reached is higher, I think, on this issue than anything we have in the healthcare poll. At the moment, at Joanne's suggestion, we offered everybody an alternative for the ACA. We could barely find anything that people wanted, including Republicans with their tax credit plan.
Ryan has, and many Republicans are offering is a.
And we did the same thing with Medicare, and there's no agreement for that. And then you have this one issue sitting there, concern about high drug prices, and people move over and say, I really want some sort of federal action here. So the possibility of that over the next 2 or 3 years is very, very real.
And that opposition to that concern about drug pricing, not just in our poll last month, but that's been coming up in a number of other polls for about a year and a half now, and it's building, and it's one of the rare things that you find a lot of Republicans as well as Democrats saying they're worried about this issue. In fact, it's one of their top health care concerns.
So, boss, let's take the finding that Bob's team found and put that into political construct. What would that look like? What do we think could be the mechanism for reform early next year?
It's really too soon to. It would have to be part of some kind of larger reform. And remember, this has been this idea. The Democrats have wanted it for at least 15 years now. It has never really made any progress. The pharmaceutical industry is very powerful and does not want it. Could you have a narrower version of it, which is something that President Obama has proposed in the last few years, which is you can negotiate some but not all drugs, certain high costs. You have some criteria. The idea of Medicare negotiating all drug prices, I think, is a tough sell politically. Given the public concern, could there be some kind of a fallback and they would negotiate in certain conditions, maybe? I still think that's tough politically, even though there's more of a popular support for it. We all know how hard it is to, I think you may see more other attempts to deal with drug pricing and sort of ways that are wonkier than we probably want to go into here, or that's a whole
other
discussion.
One is easier because it's come up in a lot, is loosening trade laws.
that pharmaceuticals can come in from a select group of other countries. And so when you have Senator Cruz proposing that, John McCain proposing that, you have some basis for that. And most Americans are aware that drug prices, one reason or another, are less expensive in Canada and Europe. And so the idea that you could, you know, CVS could import directly from purchasers is one way of indirectly dealing with that. And that's a nightmare for many pharmaceutical companies as well as the price side. But these options will be on the table seriously, again, whether or not it happens. But if it doesn't happen here, my willingness to buy stock and fix in the ACA, if it's the parties are split, is much lower. Because there's a reason here, even though the industry is so powerful, of finding something that you can do, because both constituencies are just got worried about this.
One of the interesting takeaways from this poll is there's a ranking of the most important health issues to voters. The number one issue, Medicare, 42% of voters said that's the most important issue to their vote. Moving down, abortion, only 25%. For all of the strong feelings on both sides, it ranks lower. Than even further down, cancer research, Zika funding, which...
We were sort of surprised about the medical research not being as much of a priority. We just, I mean, sometimes polls just come up with funny things and... that usually that's sort of a very bipartisan thing in Congress. There's the Cures Bill that at this writing has been stuck for many months, but there is a lot of bipartisan sentiment about increasing the NIH budget. The legislation is bogged down for all sorts of reasons with where do we take the money from? How much, do we do mandatory? Do we do, there are all these sort of technical things as well as some political. But the basic bipartisan sentiment is there's a huge amount of really innovative life sciences going on in this country right now.
So that tees up my next question, which is looking at this poll and this list of rankings, the things that we tend to hear the most about here at Politico, the issues that are really getting juice, more money for cancer research, more money for Zika funding, abortion as a tipping point back and forth, those rank lower on voters' priorities.
So let me explain the abortion issue, because it's things that people don't understand. For 25% of voters, and it turns out to be equal on both sides.
Yes.
Abortion is what is called in politics a litmus test issue. That is, it's not an issue which is the top issue to vote on. It's an issue where I say I can't vote for somebody who doesn't hold my position. So it's like someone, there's a politician who did something in office which is awful. I agree with them and everything. I can't vote for them.
This is also like gun control.
Yes.
Like certain issues.
But even,
that are,
right. But it turns out abortion's even higher on that ranking.
Yeah, 25%.
Yes. And it's around this, I just can't vote for you if you're not where I am. But it's not the top issue for the country. I just can't vote for you.
Is abortion the high? I mean, I know the litmus test idea, especially with Roe v. Wade and the appointing justices who are where they sit on abortion issues. Is this the number one litmus issue at the end of the day, abortion?
I would think so. It's still more than guns. If you had 25% of people actually voting on the gun issue, it would likely shift. Some of the outcomes.
Shift what way?
If you look at things like gun checks and all, even Republicans are mildly overwhelmed. So it has to do with the gun community having so much influence on one party. And I don't think their total votes is anywhere near as high as abortion. But it's effective because the other side doesn't have a litmus test. I can't vote for John McCain in Arizona unless he's against, he's for tougher gun control. So I think it's not as strong. It could be 5 years from now. But abortion is sort of still sits there because it has a moral and a women's rights component that guns itself doesn't have. It doesn't have the same ethical issues. What makes that issue so terrible politically is that both sides believe there is an ethical basis for their stand.
And you've also seen it identify more with party in the sense that there used to be more pro-choice Republicans and more pro-choice Democrats. There's still a handful on each side, but it has aligned more. It's very hard. Unless you're Susan Collins, to be a pro from Maine. Yeah. There just aren't as many. This has been a litmus test for many years now. It is intensified rather than gone away. It has permeated our politics in many ways, healthcare and, you know, ACA coverage and the exchange, and as well as obviously the Supreme Court battles. And I think that it has become much more identified with a party. So it is for many people, it's why you're a Democrat. For 25% on each side, it's why you're a Democrat. It's why you're a Republican. And it's pretty, you know, if that's really your abiding religious belief, a defining value of yours, it's hard not to have it be a priority.
So this broader theme of the partisan split on healthcare writ large and then these individual health issues, obviously not new. And I was looking, Bob, at some of your older data back in 2004, after the election. Kerry voters were three times more invested in healthcare issues than Bush voters. Democrats have just gravitated towards healthcare as a priority in a way that Republicans have not. My question is this, and you two are the perfect people to ask as polling expert and healthcare journalism expert who's tracked from different sides. How much more has healthcare become a partisan issue in the past number of years, and how much did Obamacare accelerate that?
Either one.
Well, I think it's, you know, I think if you look at like an exit poll and you see that healthcare is not the top issue, you know, when we go to the polls in November, I don't think healthcare is going to be the number one issue or the number two or the number three. But I think that it's been politicized and it's been this raw open wound in our politics for, you know, at least since the Clinton plan and periodically before that with fights about socialized medicine. You know, by the Clinton plan, I mean 93, 94 in the Bill Clinton era. It's become very, I think it's very baked in. So it's not so much, well, this is, I'm going to vote for this candidate or that candidate because of healthcare. It's more like that is part of my identity as a Republican or that is part of my identity as a Democrat. And it's assumed that you're going to have a certain kind of position on healthcare. That it's not so much, well, I'm going to evaluate this particular candidate. I mean, that's why I think we didn't hear much about it. We had, what, 17, am I remembering right? 17 Republican primary candidates. We didn't hear a lot about the ACA because what were they to do? Say, I'm going to repeal it in 12 seconds. Well, I'm going to repeal it in 10 seconds. I mean, it was a given that if you were a Republican, you were going to vow to repeal Obamacare, with Kasich a little bit of an outlier only on the Medicaid part, but even he said he was repealing Obamacare.
Right. Kasich expanded Medicaid in Ohio. Yes.
But it's sort of your starting point when you decide who you are. Are you a conservative? Are you a liberal? Are you a Democrat? Are you a Republican? Your healthcare is sort of just, you know, part of your way you think about politics and about government.
Well, I think I want to go back to something that you just said, Joanne. Like, yes, the Clinton years, healthcare was a partisan issue and it split the country then too. But it seems to me, as someone who's a little bit newer on this beat, that maybe the opinions are even more calcified and fully formed. And maybe that gets back to there are fewer moderate Dems and moderate Republicans on both sides. There's more of a push. Do you see that in the polling data, Bob?
Yes, but it's important to pay a bit of attention to the birth of the ACA. So let me take you back to Medicare. It's what I like to call the urban legends. People have a belief about Medicare that isn't correct.
So we're going all the way back.
Yeah, no. So
50 years back.
Public opinion, 61% favor Medicare. Public opinion for the ACA, 42%. Basically, Johnson's able, after a big landslide, to get a quarter of the House and a third of the Senate to vote for Medicare. Republicans.
We're talking now in the 1960s.
Yes. 1960s. There are Republican co-sponsors of the Medicare bill. There's somebody called Jake Javits. We even have a few buildings named after him. So the bill is passed. It has bipartisan support at 61%. And then comes the birth of this bill. 42% public support, not a single Republican at all, no co-sponsorship of Republicans, and all prior Republican presidential candidates criticizing the bill. So this bill was born meant to be a conflict between parties. Look how easy it is. Nobody in my party that I will ever run against ever voted for this bill. And the public was never for it. So, I mean, this is an ideal thing to create a political situation. If the Clinton plan had passed, they managed to get only one Republican, Joanne, to co-sponsor it. So the Clinton plan, too, would not have been much different
than this. They could not get Republican co-sponsors. When you have a major bill that changes life and no one in the other party supports it, it becomes an open sore for the next 20 years. And that's what we're living with. They couldn't get a co-sponsor. They couldn't get one vote. And they couldn't convince the majority of Americans. They said, look, this is the most popular thing we ever had. You have to go along with this. From the day it was passed, it was not the most popular thing. So it opened up the possibility that when every Republican runs, I just have to say I want to get rid of this thing because it has no downside. In the primary, I will have no opponent who will say fix it. So the way it was born has created this. And just for the historic record here, the House voted 60 times, and it's only 6 years, to repeal this. Medicare is 60 years old. Number of votes to repeal? Zero. No House has ever voted to repeal the Medicare law. Why? It's the birth. Births matter in politics, and that's what happened. You needed more people, and you needed some Republican to say this is a good thing for the future of American health care.
Right, and no Republican has said that. And if you go back, I mean, Republicans say, you know, Obama didn't want to, the Democrats didn't want to be partisan, didn't want to be bipartisan, you know, they shut us out, et cetera. If you look, I mean, the Democrats would counter that, you know, then-Senator Baucus, the chairman of the Finance Committee, spent months trying to negotiate with the Republicans. So the Republicans' perception is that they were shut out, and the Democrats' perceptions, we tried to compromise. At the end of the day, the Obama administration had the choice of doing it, going it alone, or not doing it.
Right.
That was really what they came down to, and sort of how you see the path to that point of all Democratic or drop it depends on where you're coming from politically in the first place, how you perceive where they got to that point.
I want to take the conversation in a slightly different direction, and that's
good. But most of the people listening were not born at the time the Medicare discussion was going on. I perfectly understand
right.
that, right?
Well, we don't know. Yes, I mean, maybe they could be. But we need a good poll, actually, of our listeners. Bob,
right.
If I can talk to you after this podcast about commissioning one. The question I have in the middle of this heated and increasingly messy campaign is about polling data. And famously, the Clinton camp, and inheriting this from the Obama campaign, very micro-targeted with their data. The Trump camp, less savvy with using data and polling. When you watch this election, Bob, and when you see like Hillary Clinton at a debate listing off a list of priorities that she's going to accomplish, what do you know as a polling expert that the average viewer might not know about how these messages are getting calibrated?
From the polling perspective or the candidate perspective?
Well, I
worry about the candidates so that's, for this. But back to the polling side, so it's very hard to explain. We're in the middle of a technological revolution. So everybody walking around with their iPhone knows what I'm talking about. Polls were done by telephones for 50 years, first by in person, then by telephone. We're now moving to some online mix, and we're dealing with the fact that we now have to interview 60% of people by cell phone. So just think about the problems of getting them. You also have to tell them before they pick up the phone, is your life at risk? Are you driving? You know, for that. So
how often do they say that?
So they have to by federal law. But what's happened is that a number of, including media companies, say, I can't afford to do this. So they're doing online polls without investing a lot to try to deal with the fact that lots of people don't answer online polls, and it's just too expensive. So when you read the newspapers, they try to explain who's in the sample. Do they do cell phones? Do they follow up with these people? And so the expense is going very, very high. And it turns out if you're in the media world, you get great readership if you poll states. And that is very expensive. So many of the controversial polling has to do that firms use the least costly way they can.
Sorry, I need to jump in. When you say poll states, are you talking about
people in an individual state?
Got it.
So it's very hard for Americans to understand. Your average poll has 1,500 people called, and it's actually, which no one in a focus group can believe, somehow represents all people in America. I've never seen average people believe that, but it does. But if I go and have to survey Iowa or Florida or California, I basically have to survey 1,000 more people. So the cost of doing the swing states has gone up, and many have said, what can we do to just cut costs? So the articles, New York Times and others, they are weeding out people that they think are cutting corners, and then they're trying to average among those they think are the strongest polls. So that's all the adjustments that they're making for it. If I was a listener, I would have no idea of what people are talking about. Why is one better than another? And
well,
yes.
So I mean, to paraphrase what I'm hearing, the quality of the polls has gone down in part as some companies have maybe gotten out of the business, or there's fewer desire to fund some of this work, and their corners might be getting cut. You are now alluding to something that we talked about right before going on air. The Upshot in the New York Times has run a series of stories on the quality of polling, and they did a very interesting experiment about a month ago, took raw data, gave it to four different respected pollsters who all came back with very different answers. I think there was like a 5-point swing in Clinton versus Trump support in Florida.
So this is easy to answer, not the right problem. So if you have a decent sample, your biggest problem is who's going to vote. And so what experts do, and I participated in one group, is I say, what's most important to me is, did you vote in the last two elections? And then somebody else says, no, it's if you follow the news closely. And then somebody else says, no, I actually can answer the question that may ask is, do you know where you actually vote? So what each expert does is they take the result of our poll, just like we did it, and they add these other questions. And they say, these people are not going to vote, even though they said on your poll, because they don't know where to go. They didn't vote last time. They don't follow the news. The other expert says, no, in my model, following the news isn't very important. And by the way, I don't know where I'm going to vote.
Let me repeat this back to you because I want to make sure I'm getting it. Yeah. What you're saying is that some of the discrepancy is about identifying the sample, who should be included in the sample or not.
Of who's actually going to vote.
How do you define a likely voter?
Yes. So what they gave them was the same poll result, just like the what we would have. And then they said, how would you decide who was going to vote? And each of them had a different way of
cutting that out,
doing that. Yeah. And so as someone who follows this, and I'm obsessed with the UK Brexit experience, is
I
that
can
real...
attest that he's obsessed with it. Yes. Every time we talk, he brings it up.
Yes. And so
he was there
really,
right after.
Really good people were unable to predict who was going to vote. And it turned out disproportionately people who wanted out of the European Union voted. And the people who said on the polls, I'm for UK forever in the union, stayed home.
And I think this year, it's an unconventional, I mean, none of us have ever seen a candidate
right.
like Donald Trump,
right.
and none of us have seen a political year like this year. So if you're making your polling models based on historical pattern, I don't know how much those historical patterns matter. I mean, none of us saw this year unfolding the way it unfolded.
Yes.
But I also want to come back to what you asked before we got in this broader discussion about polling, because you asked about what are the candidates seeing in, you know, in the polling right now. And one of the things that our poll found is even though a lot of people don't want much the government to have much to do with healthcare, they do want a government role in slowing the rising cost of healthcare.
Yeah.
So that plays to both that I think there's a component of the Hillary Clinton voter there who, you know, when they don't love the ACA, that's because it's still expensive. There's some affordability questions this year that weren't there last year. And so she's saying, I'm going to make it more affordable. I mean, her agenda is a very consumer agenda. She's trying to talk about affordability and pocketbook. So I think some of these people who want government role is going to be a Hillary voter. And then some of them may be, I can't tell from this piece of paper I'm looking at right now, but it may tie into the across-the-board Republican, Independent, and Democratic concern about drug prices. So they may, some of that figure may be some Republicans in there who want the ACA to go away, bye-bye Obamacare, but, you know, bring down those cancer drugs and that hepatitis drug. And there's now some, like, acne drug. I mean, it's not the public does not see it as an outlier. They see it as a problem with drug costs. You know, the EpiPen. I mean, I'm allergic to bees. I now call my EpiPen my conflict of interest pen. But, you know.
Getting all kinds of scoops on this podcast. But so we know that the Clinton campaign, which is so savvy on data, probably would look at a finding like that. It's more poll driven and take away the message that maybe this is some priority for them. Are there any, Bob, any messages you've heard in the campaign, either campaign, I guess, but where your ears perked up and said, I know that the candidate is saying this thing because it is driven by what the polling is telling the candidate to do?
So the easiest thing is the most recent debate with Secretary Clinton. She took her 2 minutes to describe how middle-income people benefited by the ACA. And the only reason why you would use 2 minutes in national television is a poll result which said most middle-income people don't think the ACA has done anything for them. So she emphasized the staying children on age 26, lifetime limits, pre-existing conditions, because the polls say there's nobody grateful as middle income. All we see are increased prices for that. So she absolutely, in my mind, I almost laughed because she did it the way you would do. What's the most popular thing in the ACA if you knew it was there? And she went down every one of those. So that was very responsive. Funny as it is, so Mr. Trump, when asked what he would do about his new bill, emphasized buying insurance between states. And I believe that was the least controversial of some of the things that are in the Republican bill. It may or may not work, depending on experts, but a lot of people watch the Geico ads, and they say, oh, I can get Geico, and I live in North Dakota, and here and that. It is state-adjusted. So I think he picked something he thought was the least controversial thing that he could throw out in his 1 minute about fixing the ACA.
Maybe that's what the Obama administration always needed, was a cute little lizard.
Yes, yes, no question, yes.
Well, I think that healthcare has always needed a villain or hero, and that's one reason why drug price reform has gotten some momentum. Now we've got these like made-for-TV villains, and if only there was a symbol on the need for coverage expansion, too.
Can we just take one more on this? Because there is a finding here. One of the things that if you spend a lot of time polling individuals about their lives is they're not policy oriented. It's individual situations which really capture their attention. So the EpiPen, the various high drugs, people can really understand something's going on. This can't be right. But the idea of whether or not we should have massive negotiations between Medicare and pharmaceuticals is very far from people.
Right.
But the minute they see an individual case, they say, that can't be right. So the way people reason is case leads to thinking of policies. The way people in Washington reason is policies and give me a case. I'll just have 1 second on my evening news. I'll give an example. But rather, it goes the other way with people. They see things and they just say it isn't right. And then somebody says to them, well, this policy will deal with the EpiPen. And we've seen 3 or 4 examples which are just tragic. People are just infuriated around examples that people can relate to.
So just taking that kind of and bringing it into the polling world, people get motivated by one case and that might lead to downstream effects. People sometimes also grab one poll, one finding that proves a point, and then wave that around and say, now we need to have this be an issue. So at the end of the day, this goes for both of you, how much should we trust a poll? And how much should we trust polls writ large, given some of the murky science that we've just talked through?
Well, I think some of the things that have cropped up in this poll and in the prior poll we did a few weeks ago have stood out. And others, polling, I think the wisdom of polling is very accumulative. It's very, you know, incremental. One poll is not going to give, it's a snapshot that has a bunch of assumptions right under it. So if you can, it's not even a snapshot. You know, it's a snapshot blended with these assumptions. So, you know, some
did
of what
did you say
we're,
blended or blended?
No.
I'm trying to avoid that one.
So what we see here, some of it confirms what we've seen about drug prices, right? We've been seeing that. The first time I saw it was in a Kaiser poll about a year and a half ago, maybe longer, Kaiser Family Foundation poll. And that was really that was a real striking one where it showed Democrats, Republicans, and independents. That's what let us know that, you know, let me know We were just hiring a couple of pharma reporters then, let me know that it was a very smart thing to hire two pharma reporters, that drug pricing was going to be a big issue because it's so rare to find Republicans, Democrats, and independents agreeing on what the top problem in healthcare was. But it was also a pocketbook issue. It was more of a very consumer-y issue. It wasn't there wasn't agreement on a solution. And we've seen that in several other polls, including our own last month. And I, you know, what we wrote about that was the public does not see it as a single couple outliers. I mean, as I said before, they're seeing this as an industry problem. And I think our the data across party lines in our poll shows that, too. There is a mounting public concern. I mean, in my case, my EpiPen is actually paid for pretty well by Politico's health insurance. But, you know, I am aware what's happened. I mean, you can't work here and not be aware of what happened. The prices went way up. Not everybody has great health insurance, you know, and sure, I can buy my EpiPen. There are people struggling.
And the takeaway being that our new poll, which has some important findings, is building on the findings of previous polls. I guess to you, Bob, how much, as someone on the inside, how much do you trust a poll? And maybe what do you look for that you know to look for that an average reader should also be looking for to decide whether a poll really is valid and trustworthy? Is it the sample size? Is it the organization that conducted it?
So if we're just talking about the most polling that's done in the U.S. is sort of just election horse race polling. In that, I recommend the people who average. So it turns out from a lot of research, the average in most elections beats almost all but the best of the polls. So somebody without endorsing Real Clear Politics or the Huffington Post, the averager or 538, the average is on a tracking side. One individual about issues are the things you have to pay attention to. Often they tap into things in people's lives that no other poll did, and it alerts you. So you always want to replicate again, but the individual polls alert you about things going on in people's lives. For that. So about what do I do about trusting something, you're stuck. If I trust the news source I use, I should trust their poll. If I don't trust the news source, don't. Never go with a poll that was paid for by the industry who can't afford the wrong answer. So a lot of polls floating around are, you know, paid for by whatever it is would be a lot better. So I don't even read what's in
like
it.
That's like a push poll.
Yes,
where the association is
even if
for.
They're the best in the world.
I once had some public relations person call me repeatedly about a poll about headaches, and it was sponsored by an aspirin company. No, I mean I wasn't political yet, but you know, in my prior job, I did not write about that poll I assumed that people did not like headaches.
I can ask my boss in real time an important question here. Writing the Pulse newsletter, someone is usually sending me a poll any given day on some issue. Often it's paid for by an association. Sometimes we feature those polls, sometimes we don't.
We tend to stay away from them.
I mean,
I've discussed them.
Yeah.
We tend to stay away from them, or we, if it's interesting, we might want to throw it out there in a paragraph in a newsletter, not a whole story about it with
the
context.
Caveat, yeah.
You know, this is who sponsored, this is, you know, we're saying, you know, sometimes if it's an interesting thing that we think our readers would want to know about, we'll give it a paragraph, but explaining so-and-so paid for it. And you know, we don't, I mean, our email inboxes are flooded with industry-sponsored poll or interest group-sponsored poll, and they rarely come out with a finding damaging to the person that paid for it.
And Harvard's team never does those kinds of polls, we should be clear.
Yes.
As far as I know.
Yes,
yeah.
We don't.
No, we wouldn't be working with them if they did.
Yeah. So the for that. But the sponsorship thing is really important. In the healthcare thing, the most recent, and some people were discriminating, the local newspapers have not been interested in whether or not you care or not in your state if they extend Medicaid. There have been very few media polls about that. The people who did the media polls on that were people who had a very strong interest. That doesn't mean they were wrong. So one side, they're hospitals, the other, they're business groups. And when you look at them, you say, wow, regardless of where I stand, they're making sure that I stand where they stand for it. But a lot of people have sort of run those, our state, everybody wants Medicaid. No, our state thinks the taxes will go up. So being independent. But in terms of tracking things over time, averages work. But an important thing about what we're trying to do here is we are pushing people more about their lives and how they think about things. And that really adds a lot. So my interpretation, we have all these people saying they want a public option. I don't believe until you tell them what a public option is, they could possibly know. What they're actually saying is, I want some sort of just a government alternative to these private insurance companies that are leaving the state. And so that's a signal for people who do that. Not that they are endorsing the Smith bill or the Jones bill, but something is going on where they want some alternative from government. You could see that on the growth of the charter schools originally. People just wanted some other way of having a choice. But that doesn't mean they thought about vouchers or this, but it sends a signal out there. Are people struggling to find some alternative to either a public school or the current insurance situation? And that's where polls help writers, because you have to define what it is that they might have a choice of. And so, you know, people are going to say, oh, they all want to buy the public option. No, they don't. They want something that is an alternative to what is in that ACA now.
So I'd like to bring our conversation to a close by closing with what we call the lightning round. And the goal is to answer quickly, lightning bolt style, though if you're more of a rolling hurricane storm kind of guy, Bob, and you need a little extra time, that's fine. And Joanne, these questions are for Bob, but as Bob's muse, if you feel like you need to jump in and edit in real time his answers, I think that's, well, we'll see what happens. So Bob, if you're game, first lightning round question. You mentioned Nate Silver in 538. Has his work and all that attention been a boon to someone who works in polling, or has it been a burden because it's changed the perception of what polling can and should be?
Now, what people who've done a lot of analysis and then get in major media is they attracted back people who are interested in analysis. So many better educated people say, oh, I don't pay attention to those polls. They don't mean anything. And what's happened is by having writers that actually analyze data, it brings a whole group of people back in and saying, there's some really interesting, I'm intrigued by what it is. So it's absolutely helped. If you're in this world, polling is too expensive for many newspapers and television stations today. So you are worried about the Nate Silvers because questions he asks makes it difficult for you to do a low-cost survey. And anybody that studies the media knows how many people in different areas have been laid off and things closed. The polling world is being closed. Great newspapers used to have 50 years of polling. They're not there anymore. And right. It's all about costs. So you're worried about that if you're in the industry. At the same time, having more sophisticated looking at this brings an audience that we have not had in recent years.
So overall a boon, though there's nuance to what's happening in polling.
Right.
As someone who has tracked polling for years and years and years, has this made you more or less optimistic about America's political system?
I think I can on any given day blame polling for anything. The plight of our American political system is not due to polling, and I am completely worried about the future of this country. I sincerely believe, forget everything else about the Congress, is there are big problems. You have to find a way to reach a compromise. Paralysis, this isn't a partisan issue. This is that we face threats from overseas. The Zika thing from people in other countries is one of the most disgraceful votes. It's what you expect in a third world country. You have a pandemic starting, and you can't fund it, and you can't fund it because you're divided over some underlying political reason.
You're talking about the like 8-month delay.
Yes.
To fund
so,
Zika.
I mean, this is a dangerous phenomenon. It has nothing to do with partisanship. There are real issues facing this country, and if we can't break through for this. Now, polling is not a solution because good polling says to you, wow, somebody in Wyoming is really polarized over this issue. So it isn't a solution. But the big issue is that countries cannot deal with the problems we face unless they have a mechanism to reach agreement. And so I've gotten very discouraged about primaries. I used to believe that primaries were a way for thoughtful voters to pick candidates. I won't comment on that at the moment, except I just believe it's no longer a way for us to pick thoughtful voters to pick candidates. But something's wrong when you cannot reach agreement. You can't even reach a budget agreement.
Well, I want to push on my original question. The raw polling data that you see, Americans might not be informed when we talk about when there's a question that should illuminate, do people understand that something is an issue? And the polling data that comes back to you is most people don't understand it. Recently, there was the Kaiser Family Foundation survey where most Americans didn't realize that the uninsured rate is historically low. How do you reconcile that? Does that make you just pessimistic about the country and the amount of information that people don't know? Or is that just par for the course?
So we have a different view of this. I'm a teacher. My view is I survey my students to find out what they know. Therefore, I think people in the press, now that they know this, should do something about it. So I'm not at all bothered that people whose lives are very busy at this moment don't know some fact. I'm bothered if nobody on television or radio or online news chooses to tell them a fact. But I think it's very useful. And I think it was terrific that Secretary Clinton said, by the way, this bill has five things in it that could have helped you. She would not have done it unless a poll said they don't even know. So it's very hard to educate people. Their lives are very busy. But I'm very big on feedback. If you don't know how the Medicare drug benefit works, then I think somebody's obligated to tell you. But the poll allows you to say to people, they don't know this. They're not policy wonks for that. But a role of media is not only to love conflict, but also to explain to people what is the basic facts behind the issue here.
Well, we can leave it on that optimistic and not just optimistic note, but a homework assignment from the teacher and a dean of polling. Bob Blendon, thank you for making time. Joanne Kennan, my boss, thank you for joining us too.
What a terrific opportunity to be here together. Yes.
That's it for Pulse Check this week. Thanks to our producer, Bridget Mulcahy. And please remember to find and subscribe to Pulse Check on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, Overcast, etc., etc., etc. All the podcast apps, we should be there. You should be able to find us. And if not, let me know at ddiamond@politico.com. And we'll be back with a new episode of Pulse Check next week.